Happy St. Patrick's Day, Montreal. We've talked about a lot of things in this show over the past couple of months. War, pestilence, death, all the fun stuff. But today we're really going to take a challenge to open the show with. We'll bring you all our usual serious stuff, but we are glad to report that our friend, Richard J. McEconomy, Esquire.
Joseph Patrick, yes, Joseph Patrick.
J.P.?
J.P.
R.J.P. McEconomy.
Richard
You've
J.
never told me that, right?
It's a secret of the family for years and years and years.
Really? So I can call you Pat?
You can call me Pat.
I can call you Joe.
You can call me anything. Just call me.
At any time.
Right. I charge for phone
survived.
Calls.
Survived. This man survived a 5.5 mile march up Fifth Avenue with the Aaron Sports Club, which last year, we are proud to say, as Montrealers, won the award for best marching group. And there they were, 40 of them. Top hats, black coats, white scarves, shillelaghs.
White gloves.
White gloves.
White gloves.
White gloves, too.
Yeah, the Cardinal said to say hello to you, Beryl.
What the Cardinal say then?
Cardinal Regan. Cardinal Regan came to our group and said, you fellas from out of town. And we said, yes. Well, he said, two or three of you. Well, no, we're 40. He said, you come down and watch the parade. We can't walk in the parade. We didn't come to watch the parade. He thought we were very nice. We liked him. He was very kind.
Did he give you a blessing?
He gave us a blessing, a
what
special
blessing?
Irish blessing. Don't ever walk in front of a truck if your mother's behind the wheel.
Now, Rick.
Yes.
Rick, we understand that we've got, and Montreal out there and everybody listening on the web, we've got the Irish whiskey on the table.
You got it.
And you've got to see McEconomy decked out with his top hat. He's got his shillelagh here and his sash.
I'm holding the sash up to the microphone for all of you at home. I hope you're catching this.
Now, Rick, what was the most difficult part of this march? The long march.
Walking.
Walk.
I got about an hour of waiting around done, and my knees gave out.
Your knees?
I almost crawled the rest of the way. It was a pathetic thing to think.
Was it really?
I was up in the front of the group.
The front of the group, you said.
And I was going forward.
Where?
And
forward.
Suddenly the knees lets go. So there I am. So I go to the back.
Both knees at once, or?
Left and right.
Left and right, son.
Back I go to the back, right? And the guys at the back were walking a lot slower than the guys at the front.
Well, you were the slimmest
of the
group.
It was a terrible relief to me.
A relief.
I was the shortest.
And the slimmest.
Thinnest. And prettiest guy in the group.
Prettiest we know.
Yeah, that's why they kept me in the middle of the group. You know New York, eh? You can't be too careful.
I certainly do. Now, was there a place to relax for all you guys? I mean, after such a strenuous effort.
Oh, we were at the Riverside Towers Hotel.
Sounds very fancy.
Oh, it was fancy, I can tell you. It had suites of rooms.
Sweet.
There's 183 listed hotels in New York, and this is the 182nd.
So, from the top or the bottom?
From the it wasn't the second.
What were
the
best amenities that we had there?
The amenities were there was one fellow who was complaining a little.
Why was he complaining?
Well, you see, he goes in and he gets into the shower. You see, and the shower is a little small because it's like a
small suite
hotels. You had to share a bathroom with four other people, five in some cases. The other guy we didn't know, but somehow they sent him up. Right?
He was there anyway, right?
He liked the liquor. So
he gets into
the shower, and he gets finished on it, the front side, and then he's got an emergency.
The shower sounded like this, right? This is the liquor being poured in Montreal, right here.
You're lovely.
I hope you can hear this.
You're lovely.
There you go,
you're
Rick.
Lovely. So he has to step out of the shower to turn around and do his back. It was the most amazing thing we never saw. You don't sit around watching people in the shower, unless you're sort of a little strange.
Yes. It's one of these proverbial little rooms where you have to go outside to change your mind.
Yeah, it's a perverted little room.
A perverted little room, you say. Where the little leprechauns running around in that room.
Well, you go into the room and there's a single bed.
One bed.
And you say, hey.
Five Irishmen in one bed.
Two of us here, and there's one bed. And you got to check for the guy, see if he smiles. If he smiles, you're in trouble, right?
So what does that mean, if he smiles?
The bed slips
out.
Well,
to those of us who aren't, you know, today everybody's Irish, but...
I can't say it on the radio.
Why? It's just between you and me.
Okay. Just between you and me?
Just between you and me.
He may be in love with your sister.
Really?
Yeah. Right? So you go in the place, and you slide this bed out, and if you push it too far to the back, you can't get into the bathroom. You cannot get into the bathroom.
Try to say it in one sentence, Rick.
Bathroom, not into get. Right? There you are. But
we're
going to
have a
thing away from the bathroom
door. Anglais soon here.
The language police are on their way. Please, gentlemen,
the
wait. The English ones. It was a terrific weekend. We had a great time.
You
Three
think
days.
You'll win?
I think we'll win. We won last year. They created a trophy for us last year.
What's it look like?
It was about 2.5 feet tall. It's a filigree imitation, totally non-distinct gold, right? And it says, for the best marching unit in the 2005 St. Patrick's Day Parade in Newark, New Jersey, crossed off New York City.
Spelling problem there?
They had one sort of hanging around that they hadn't used, right?
Tell us about the Aaron Sports Club.
The Aaron Sports Club is the finest bunch of men that I've ever been associated with in my entire life. What they do is they
You've been associated with a lot of men in your life, Rick.
And yeah, well, my father started the whole thing.
Did he really?
And, yeah.
Did he now?
They do fundraising for amateur sport in the Southwest, LaSalle, Verdun, and Point St. Charles. Mostly guys from the neighborhood or guys that are like who've made it out of the neighborhood and the second generation just couldn't make it out of the neighborhood, so they had to go back to the neighborhood, right, to find a little bit of, you know, friends. Right.
Certainly.
It's a great thing. They do a 1,000-person breakfast every year. They raise about $150,000, which is a total exaggeration. But we're Irish, you know.
And we're going to come back with total exaggerations right after this. We can make some bills for the exaggerations.
Go for it.
Irish Montreal, which we all are today. We're back, and this is not going to be a normal show. We're just bringing the economy down from the wall. I've got to make a technical announcement that apparently when I was starting to talk to him, I was going off air because my mic wasn't in front of my mouth. That's only because he and I were trying to kiss, but right now I'm trying to get him down the wall. So, Big Mac, you were telling us about the exaggerated fundraising that the Aaron Sports Club
does. Oh, yes. So, no, they do excellent work. The Children's Hospital, various other charities in the city, they're big supporters of the Shriners and the Shriners Hospital. They have 1,000 to 1,200 people a year at their breakfast, and it's just a great bunch of guys. We had a heck of a time, 40 of us down in a bus, Montreal to New York. It was wonderful. You know, when you go to the duty-free, you know, and you realize you're leaving your own country and you're making a record purchase of duty-free, and none of it's chocolates or perfume, you know, you're on the right track.
What were you buying then?
Well, they were buying stuff in a lot of necessary stuff
for a campaign.
Necessary stuff. You had to buy a couple of scarves in case you got lucky. You know?
Certainly, of course.
And stuff
nylons
like that.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
But, mostly liquor.
Mostly liquor. Liquor's good. Yeah. And it was cold there in New York.
Oh, wasn't that cold? None of the boys complained about the cold. At all. I've never heard them complain about the cold, indoors or out. I left the window open in the hotel. I was sleeping on the floor because we couldn't get the bed that's supposed to spring up. So I'm lying on the bed.
And you're a sensitive fellow.
Oh, and I'm freezing to death. And I know I'm Irish because what I did is I wrapped myself tighter in the clothes instead of get up and closing the window like an idiot, right?
Like an idiot as opposed to what?
Yeah, well, this is where they invented the sleeping bag. Irish guys rolling around in their clothes.
Wait a minute. You mean the Irish invented the sleeping bag?
And baseball. All in the same week. It's an amazing time of year. You were empowered. The Irish this time of year are empowered. They'll claim anything.
Aaron go bra.
You got it.
Well,
or bra less.
Or bra less.
Right.
But
Aaron go bra less. Yeah, your boyfriends love it.
On an individual or communal level.
This is it. Right.
It does sound, though, Richard Joseph Patrick McConomy, that the road truly rose up to meet you and the wind was always at your back during this parade.
This is true. This is true. And thank God I'd rather be facing the wind after you've had one of those Irish meals.
Well, the Irish meal is liquid. They're right in front of you.
Oh, no. I swore off that stuff years ago. I have to wait until I'm 87, and I can start drinking again and still hit the national average before I'm gone. But it's a wonderful thing. It keeps you warm in the winter, and it improves your mood. There's nothing depressing about it. I think alcohol is a very, very nice, very nice, very nice thing. And it runs the economy. It contributes to taxes and things like that.
And it's blessed, and it can pay for over $1 million in expenses for the board of directors. So. Yeah.
And if ever you wanted native people to give you land,
yes,
it was always good in exchange.
That's all you needed.
Yeah, yeah. Historically, it had a great role in this country. But no, it's a lovely thought.
And on another show, we will discuss who actually invented whiskey first, the Irish or the Scots.
Discuss? Did you say discuss?
It's a terrible
time of the year for really offering any doubts in your mind.
Not when I'm tasting the peat in this whiskey. No.
I just want to say hello to somebody today.
Please.
I forget his name, but it's the guy that was objecting to us having shamrocks and drunkenness as the centerpiece of this celebration.
And the coat of arms.
Want to say we went to McDonald's on the way down to New York, and we had like a little bit of time off from all of that abuse. Of those shamrocks and things. They had guys actually selling shamrocks in cellophane bags down there.
Did you bring me back one?
It's on my
you didn't bring me back a shamrock.
It's on my nightside table. Look for it later
this
afternoon.
You didn't bring me back a shamrock. I'm hurt. I may not be able to continue now.
Well, I have here a picture of Cardinal Egan of the St. Patrick's
Cardinal
Church.
Egan, you said. Edward Egan.
Edward Cardinal Egan, Archbishop of New York. He was asking for you.
Was he really?
Yeah, he said, is my friend, what's his name? So I knew it had to be
it
you.
It had to be
right?
Me, of course.
Is my friend, what's his name, from Montreal out there? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's good. I have in front of me here the program for
it's
the St. Patrick's
program.
Day Parade
it's
in New
green
York.
It's green and orange.
Yeah. And, you know, for Enron and all of that, they decided to make the head of the New York Stock Exchange. He's the Grand Marshal.
The Grand Marshal's the head of the Stock Exchange.
Yeah. And he said things like, from my cell here where they put me where I shouldn't be, I want all my friends to know that whatever it is they think I did, I didn't do it. I wasn't there, and me brother was out of town that day, too. So this is a little Irish humor for you.
So all in all, it ended on a high note.
All in all, it ended on a very high note. I got my knees home, I got a good night's sleep, and now I got to go out and walk in the parade in Montreal.
Before we get into some serious conversation, which we still have to do because that's supposedly what they don't pay us for.
Right.
Describe the transportation.
Oh, the transportation.
Of the Aaron Sports
Club. Oh, it's a wonderful
thing. Back and forth.
It's a large bus.
How large a bus?
40 people big.
Right? 40 people big or 40 people in?
40 people big bus it was, right? It was a bus with 40 big people in it. The only problem was they had one of those small doors at the back where you do your business.
You know? What do you mean do your business?
Well, for those and people of other cultures,
yes.
They trade drugs in these little places. We just go to the bathroom.
Oh, I see.
Right?
Okay.
Right? So,
and change into your Batman costumes.
The problem is every once in a while some poor sucker would get himself halfway in. To the back seat.
Oh, halfway.
In a state of emergency.
Because we did see pictures of you people. The girth was...
We have a fullback among the group.
Do you really?
And he runs halfway up the bus, turns around, runs all the way down, bashes a guy in.
Wasn't that the running guard?
Yeah, but the trick is when the guy hits you, you got to jump and turn. Because, boom, you're going to be on the seat, right?
And how was the suspension on the bus?
The suspension was very close to the ground. Very close to the ground.
I must say you're taking this very sagely.
Well, I try, you know, because...
Very philosophically.
The Irish take themselves very, 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 very seriously.
You did save civilization.
During the other months of the year when they're not celebrating St. Patrick's Day.
Well, it's an important celebration. Weren't you the one who told me the story of one band that was marching in a St. Patty's Day parade in Montreal that decided to march all the way to Sorel?
Yeah, well...
They forgot the march stop?
I had an even better one than that.
What's that?
We were sitting there one year doing the television coverage in the in a truck. And watching the little monitor between your knees, which is really distracting. And so you're watching the monitor and the parade.
Anything
is...
between your knees would be distracting.
Speak for yourself. So they're coming along and they're coming along and this band runs by and they go so fast. I said, gosh, that's the fastest west-east move that ever happened in this parade. And it turned out they had a maneuver where they quick turned and came back. So I'm walking at the monitor and I said, holy God, they're coming back. They came all the way back down the street, turned around, and then they stood in front of the reviewing stand, and they played the entire Soldier's Song as a march.
It's touching.
It was one of the most touching things. Actually, this is a serious time of year for us to celebrate what we celebrate and to be proud.
And truly on that note... May everybody be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows they're dead.
You got
we'll
it.
Be right back with the rest of this unserious part of the show after we pay some bills. Sitting through that very, very critical report on St. Patrick's Day.
It's a pleasure to assume some responsibility for
and,
all
And
of
you
that.
Assumed it very well, McConomy.
You know, we're that kind of people. You know,
we understand. Stout fellows.
Just watch that, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Very patiently. Is our special guest today in studio with us, Colonel Peter Reynolds. Colonel Reynolds had a distinguished career in the British Army. He served in the Balkans. He served in the first Gulf War. He was Director of Public Affairs for NATO at SHAPE headquarters in Brussels. He has just come back after a four-month stint in Iraq as Special Advisor to the United Nations on the elections. And this weekend has been the third anniversary of the invasion. Of course, we saw demonstrations out yesterday in a variety of cities. But there's more being done there than just the political side. And we want to welcome Colonel Reynolds to our studio today. And, Peter, thank you for your patience sitting through that that most serious talk.
I'll be really impressed if you get any coherent answers out of me at all.
And why is that?
After listening to the pair of you on the other side.
You're
of
very
the
serious and profound person.
Gravitas.
Great gravitas. What was the hardest thing for you in Baghdad? You were in the green zone. You were trying to control thousands of people, teaching them how to vote. You showed me a ballot that was 5 pages long.
The hardest thing was probably adjusting to the culture, as it is in all strange situations when you actually go there. And the difficulty most people have when they go to a new culture, as do we all, as do I, is it takes you some weeks, if not months, to actually get an inkling of what's going on and what's going through the mind of the people out there.
Now, you, Peter spoke at a conference that our institute, the Institute of Public Affairs, held yesterday on the Middle East. And, Peter, I know your views are that it was right to go in and you have no problem going in and taking down a guy like Saddam, but there were problems in the execution. If you had to pick three things that could be solved now or should be addressed now, what would they be?
The three things that should be addressed now: one, form a coherent government so they can actually get on and do stuff. Encourage them as much as we can, and I know that's going on, but there is a certain difficulty in that the political parties in Iraq aren't speaking to each other openly or with sufficient clarity to actually get on and do things. Two, maintain, if not improve, the current security situation in order to make the people's lives, and I'm talking about the people of Iraq's life, easier on a day-to-day basis. Give them the certainty that when they get on a bus, it isn't going to get blown out from under their feet. And three, get on with the reconstruction. There is an infrastructure which has seen no work done on it over the last 30 years, and in the last 3 years, an inordinate number of projects have been started. Carry them through to their conclusion, and let's get it up and running again. The commerce and all the rest of it can follow thereafter.
Can I just follow up on one of those? You're talking about security day to day. Could you tell us what it's like on a given day that you would have in Baghdad?
Okay, I stayed in the Hotel Rashid, which is inside the Green Zone, and my morning wake-up call could be the bomb going off at the local bus station less than a couple of miles away. And it rattles your windows, and you're out of bed, and you know that's the sort of thing that happens. And then during the day, you are actually cognizant of the fact that at regular intervals, the odd mortar bomb lands inside the compounds. It's a fairly large compound, so the chances of getting hit are fairly slim or minimal. You probably have a better chance of being run over by a bus in downtown Montreal. Do you have buses here?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Well, I don't know how they drive. But
no, we have bus drivers, male and female.
Okay. Well, your chances are probably being, you know, about as equal. I'm saying it's dangerous, of course, but it's not as dangerous as some people would like to make it.
When you talk about creating a functioning government, what I want the point I'd like you to address after we come back from news is the following. You go into a country, you take down a tyrant. As you said at the conference yesterday, you have three choices: stay in, get out, or do something constructive there. How do you go about the process of building a coherent governing or election structure when 75% of the parties are based on religious denominations and religious particularities? And I'd like you to address that point when we come back from news right after this in Montreal. We want to hear from you about Iraq and what our role should be in it and whether it was worth it or not. And that call a number 790-0006 and email info@iapm.ca, and we'll be back after news. Montreal in studio with Rick McConomy, who has briefed us on St. Paddy's Day. We've been talking with Colonel Peter Reynolds, our special guest, who was just back from Iraq, special advisor to the United Nations group overseeing the election. And as we were heading into the news, my question to Colonel Reynolds is the following. He was addressing the problem of how to make a government. It's not enough just to bring down a dictator. You've got to create a governing structure. And Peter, once again, just to repeat the question, you showed us the ballot. It's a remarkable ballot, and I wish we were on television to show Montrealers this. In Baghdad, 5 pages of parties, single-spaced, and you could pick one. And 75% of those parties seem to be faith-based. How is it appropriate, do you think, for a reconstructing organization to come in and say, not only talk about democracy, not only talk about constitutional liberalism, but actually to say, you can be fascist, you can be communist, no political party based on faith?
Can't disagree with you, Beryl. Really can't disagree.
Is that
with
the decisive factor?
There should be a secular government. There isn't. You're trying to overcome several hundred years' worth of culture and things like that. And however hard we try, it's got to be their decision. They can be encouraged along the way, but because it's an outside entity saying, look, secular government is the way to go, take the religion out of politics or whatever it is, that doesn't mean to say it's going to happen.
Would it have been inappropriate for the parameters that created the new Iraq or the Iraqi government, what is there now, the parliament, to say no parties, faith-based. How would the reaction have been?
That's very, very difficult to judge. The difficulty is the power. There is a certain degree of power both at the local, federal, and government level within the imams of the various sects and religiously based groups. How you get a grip on that power base is really, really difficult. I mean, especially as outsiders, as infidels, as are most of the coalition forces that are in there, it's an almost impossible task.
Do we get a sense of government inside of government in the sense that there are things that the imams do and that they, which would normally be done by a secular government in the West?
I believe so. And one of the fundamental errors I think that was making that was made about 3 years ago after victory was declared was to take down the top tier of everything, to disband every government institution that was functioning in a way. It may not have been functioning the way we would like it to have functioned as outsiders or whatever it is, but to take it down totally and to leave that vacuum. And that vacuum at the local level was obviously filled by the imams as soon as they could get their hands on whatever power there was lying around at the time.
So could it have been any worse had the power, the coalition that went in, had the people who had been were creating the new government structure said, no faith-based parties? Would we have had most of this civil war, let's call it that, we're seeing in Iraq, is faith-based. It's Sunni groups, Shiite groups. Would it have been any worse?
Hindsight is a great, wonderful thing, and it's usually 2020 or 1010 or whatever it is. And I'm still not certain we can identify and say that at the moment. I don't think we understand the culture well enough to be able to make those judgments sitting here in a studio in Montreal or even being out there for 3 months and just looking at it from the outside.
But this isn't a matter of a culture. This is a matter of saying that if you have a responsibility, the point you made at the conference yesterday, you don't have a, you have a greater responsibility just to come in, take down a tyrant, and you have a responsibility to rebuild, to build a civil society. Is it illegitimate to say civil society, the best model that humanity has come up with, the Western European pluralistic model that says you can have a party based on anything?
I have no
but
problem
religion
with it.
Should not be there. Is that not part of the problem in Iraq, that they've allowed religious parties, religious voices, on the same level as secular rights?
I think you're misunderstanding that. I mean, we have religious parties wherever you are in the world, be they big or small. I mean, in other parts of the world, they don't wield as much power. One of the fundamental problems that I... One of the fundamental misgivings I have is that we try to impose as what we see as the perfect system, which is a loosely based liberal democracy or whatever it is, on a people which hasn't had the opportunity to actually get a justice as to what that system is. Now, we talked yesterday briefly about benevolent dictatorship of some sort or another. Does this people need someone who is strong, who is capable of leading them forward? You know, does he have to be approved by the West? Does he have to follow all the guidelines of the West? People may actually make more progress with someone they, by popular acclaim, who is a benevolent dictator. Not in the Saddam mold. I don't mean to go back to that or whatever.
Oh, well, God. You mentioned Reconstruction and Reconstruction back to before Saddam's time. So there's Reconstruction to be done even predating.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So basically it wasn't that benevolent a situation.
No,
he wasn't talking about Saddam as a benevolent dictator.
No, I understand.
And they call me just to the right of Ivan the Terrible. Andy, how are you?
Hello there. The colonel is saying all the things that I was saying before even the war was started.
Well, you were quite prescient.
Well, the thing is this, because as he said, it should have, when the war was over, which took 3 weeks about, it should have taken 2 weeks, but the Prince of Defense, Rumsfeld, goofed, and the military guy, Tommy Franks, was actually an idiot for the way he handled the war.
How was he an idiot?
Because you should have had 150,000 men more to do the job. And when they took they beat the armies, right away, instead of, like the colonel said, we created a vacuum. They should have taken the former people who were leading the government, the generals and everything else.
Including the religious leaders?
Well, they were not religious, those guys. They were,
the imams were not religious.
No, the generals I'm talking about. The mechanism that was there should have been established without Saddam Hussein, and so that things would be going. We wouldn't have 3 years of constant killing.
Andy, the military do not switch their loyalty like just because somebody else walked in and a couple of weeks took over the country.
I don't think Andy's talking about just the military. There were secular leaders like Ahmed Shalabi, who, despite his checkered background, there were secular leaders who were backed by the West who were told that they would be put into the political system to head parties, to head institutions where the discussions would not be with the religious. They would be with the secular leaders, not even the military ones. And that didn't take off. That didn't happen.
So that's where the void got created, Peter.
I think so. I mean, yeah.
So the failure of people to come to the plate, failure of having a plan to have people come forward?
It's the failure in planning that really concerns me. They were thought about, but only, I mean, militaries are great at killing people, destroying structures, or whatever it is. It's the rebuilding effort that actually was addressed a little bit loosely, I suspect, if at all.
Andy, stay with us. We'll be right back after this, and we're going to be joined by Homa Arjaman, who will address another part of this problem, exactly the damage done by the religious leadership in Iraq. We'll be back after this. The discussion has been, how do we reconstruct Iraq, or any state, if we can't first create a secular political culture, a Western liberal pluralistic culture? And I want to read a short paragraph to you. Parties in power in the West are flirting with religious groups and then expecting that the violence against women will stop. It's a joke to wish for an environment of violence against women to stop while states endorse, fund, validate, and promote the religious political groups that are responsible for such violent actions. Obviously, states cannot talk about integration while promoting backwards anti-woman cultures and religions that segregate women from mainstream society. The woman who wrote those brave words is with us today, Homa Arjaman. She's with us today from Toronto. Homa Arjaman led the campaign in Ontario against Sharia courts. She's president of Children First Now International. And it's a pleasure to welcome you, Homa. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Homa, you've been listening to the discussion or part of the discussion, and I think this is a problem not just relegated to Iraq, where Colonel Reynolds came from, but in much of the Middle East, and indeed has now begun to affect Western Europe and North America, this political correctness towards towards a political and religious movement. What do we need to know in the West from your experience in Iran, from your experience fighting for the rights of women, from your experience reminding the public against the honor killings of Sharia justice? What does the West need to know, even more than some states like Iraq, about what we have to guard against?
First of all, I'd like to thank you by running this kind of panel discussion. This is the most helpful way to educate the public what's happening behind the closed doors. But the reality is, what he's not mentioning in here is the role of the West in order to encourage, promote, and bring up monsters as a religious monsters. Not only that, to promote their parties. And the same thing is happening in Iraq, and the same thing happened in Iran and in Middle East. And if you look at it, Khomeini was no one. He became a monster, and not only that, his party became the most powerful party in the world. This is the party which promotes and gives money to other tiny religious movements and encourages the political Islam movement.
And we know that Iran is now supporting Hamas in Palestine and Hezbollah in southern Lebanon.
Of course. And the West is promoting Iran. So it's all, if you put them all together, it's impossible to challenge this political Islam if we let the Western government continue supporting this political Islam.
What should a Western government say to political Islam?
We don't want them to say anything. We don't want any support. We want them to stop supporting. And that's every type of supporting you can even think of. Training them, giving them money, promoting them, allowing them to use the media, the TV, air, and these type of things. And these are the things we want the West to stop.
And that would include countries, well-meaning countries like Canada, stopping CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency, aid to these groups in the Middle East.
Of course. Because the only way we can let the people in the Middle East to decide what's happening in Iraq to start, you know, to do whatever they want to do if the West or the parties in power in the West stop supporting these political parties.
Are there realistic alternatives? Are there other?
That's the most realistic arguments. I think they have to stop funding their religious parties totally, any faith-based parties.
Well, they don't fund them directly. They fund them through the government.
And they fund them through different agencies.
Peter, is it possible to make that distinction, to find the alternative?
Yes, people, you know what? People, if they know what's happening behind the closed door, they can put enough pressure on the government so that the government would stop funding them to any other agency.
Well, Homa, just hold on 1 second, because this question was aimed at Colonel Reynolds. Is there a way to stop this money from getting to these religious, pseudo-religious political groups?
Yes, there is, by introducing a degree more transparency in all of these financial actions and things like that.
Transparency to whom?
Well, not only to the way that we distribute funding or whatever it is, but it's a very, very difficult subject. I mean, transparency in government is a challenge that we all will live with on an everyday basis.
There are
deals done behind closed doors, and you and I will never, ever find out about.
We're going to come back right after this break, and I'm going to put a question both to Homa and to Colonel Reynolds about transparency on an issue that we did know about in Canada and has still not stopped. And we'll be back right after this, and we encourage your call, 790-0006. Montreal, we're talking about what governments in the West can do to stop the funding of extremist groups and how money gets to the pseudo-religious, really political, and terror groups on the ground. In studio with me is Rick McConomy and Colonel Peter Reynolds, and on the phone with us from Toronto is Homa Arjamand, the head of the Children First Now International Movement, and the woman who was at the forefront of stopping the fight for the push for to have Sharia courts in Ontario. And Homa had just said that the West has got to stop funding these groups directly and indirectly. And we're talking about how do we know what they're funding. And I want to bring up a point both to Colonel Reynolds and to Homa. We know in Canada, and this has been a debate for 2 years, that CETA is peddling about $125 million a year into organizations that are supposedly educational in the Middle East and that produce the most violent and hateful anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, anti-Western dogma that goes into their school system. Do we stop this? Do we just stop it? Do we just cut it off? Or is anything to be gained by the school of thought that says, well, even with a government like Hamas, maybe they'll learn some responsibility? Homa, you take the question first, and then Colonel Reynolds.
Of course. First of all, I'm going to put one question in front of our listener. Why do we lock the doors while we know the kids can enter the house from the glass window? The question is, we make it difficult. We make it difficult for them to, they have to enter the glass window, so they have to break in. People would see them more. This is how we have to do it. We have to make sure the government would not fund any religious parties. Then they have to use this kind of, agent to go to it. It's like breaking into the house through a glass window.
Right. Peter and Rick, Homa, let me pose the question to Rick and to Peter from two different perspectives. Rick McConomy, who knows Canadian politics better than anyone in the country, we in Canada love this multicultural thing, so what Homa's suggesting, which is quite right, could be offensive. But Peter, to you, let me pose the other side of the question. Are the West just suckers? And either of you can take this.
I really have no problem with any humanitarian aid whatsoever going out.
Define humanitarian aid.
Which improves the lives of the people at large. What I do have a problem is that if programs are not supervised, we are not getting your bang for your buck, and where there is no accountability if you cock up at the other end, and that nobody makes off with the 10% off the top or the 20% of the...
Peter, you're absolutely right. I spent a term as the president of United Way Canada, and I can tell you, the one thing that we told Canadians from coast to coast in this country, we take your money, thank you very much. We take your generosity, and we are responsible for accountability. We visit the agencies. We get them to report. We verify on what they're doing. We make sure they're relevant. We make sure they're getting their business done. I don't see why we can't make that kind of thing necessary on an international basis. Well, show us on an annual basis what you've accomplished. show us and demonstrate to us that things are happening that are appropriate, and if they aren't, your funding's gone.
Okay, well, you know very well that we there was proof given to the Canadian government over the past 3 years that $125 million of aid to certain Middle Eastern groups over the past 3 years has gone for hate propaganda. Canada never cut it off. The proof was there. What do we do to our politicians?
Who does Canada have to depend on in order to do the verification? Have they established a feedback system and a responsibility for accountability?
I mean, one of the problems organizations have is they want to spend the maximum amount of money on the biggest number of projects. And it increases your overhead if you have your own oversight teams, because it means global travel.
Well, actually, Peter and Rick,
buying in
the information about how Canadian money was being compromised came from our very teams.
Contract out. We can contract out the verification systems. It's one method of doing it. The second one is, when you come for the money, tell us up front where it's going so we can go in later on and find out where it went.
Yeah, yeah.
These are very simple rules, but they're the kind of thing we've got to get to in this country. This idea of foreign aid, we give an X amount of dollars, for God's sake. You know, people in this country think that United Way is sending money overseas. Nobody knows about our overseas aid programs, and nobody ever gets any decent reporting back on it.
One of your great concerns has been honor killings and the role of women, and the frustration you must have felt, particularly in the case of the woman in Nigeria who was sentenced to be stoned to death by a Nigeria Sharia court, and Canada did nothing. What do we do with our politicians?
This is it. When the government is giving money away for promoting the religious, don't they get these mission statements? What kind of help are they going to provide?
They bury them because our foreign affairs diplomats take a look at the map and they see 24 Arab capitals and they want to be promoted to ambassador. So they bury them.
That's only a portion. That's a very small proportion of it. I think the other part of it is it's a lack of faith and a lack of self-confidence that we have. We don't believe that we can ask those hard questions and then act on the answers.
Well, we've never asked a hard question.
Homa knows we should be doing that.
Of course, but we've never asked those hard questions. How do we do it?
You know, it's not only asking the questions. I think we have to push the government. They exactly know what they're doing. It's not because they don't know. The point is the public, they don't know, and they have to promote and make public awareness. And if public get these kind of awareness, I'm sure they would push the government, and I'm sure they're going to put a system, a method in such a way that any kind of parties who are who are in contact with any kind of faith should not receive any funding. And I think the public would push the government to do
that. Homa Arjaman, we thank you very much. And maybe this should be part of a tax revolt of Canadians together with a lot of other issues. We'll be right back with you, Montreal, after the news. Montreal, welcome back. In studio, Rick McConomy, Colonel Peter Reynolds. On the phone, Homa Arjaman, head of No Sharia campaign in Ontario and president of Children First Now. And we've been talking about how Canada must take a lead, not only in the Middle East, not only in the Arab world, not only in the fight against terror, against the impact of pseudo-political religious groups, but how we should take a lead as a partner in the West. And joining us in this discussion is Professor Eleanor Sloan, professor of international relations at Carleton University and the author of Security and Defense in the Terrorist Era. And before I welcome Professor Sloan to this conversation, I want to read something she wrote. Because whatever anybody might think of what happened last week, there was something transformational in the Prime Minister's visit in Kandahar. He gave Canada a challenge. He gave us a challenge to re-engage on the world stage, and he gave us a challenge to define what we are as the people. And if as a people we're not ready to make a commitment to bring hope to oppressed, then what are we as a nation? In Afghanistan, Professor Sloan wrote, Mr. Harper said Canada should be a leader, and he is right. But that leadership must begin here, in Canada, with a commitment to the total costs associated with long-term recapitalization. Anything less will leave the Canadian military reliant on its allies for the capabilities needed to make a difference on the world stage. Professor Eleanor Sloan, we welcome you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Professor Sloan, one of the problems that was discussed in the past year is the fact that Canada, because of our namby-pamby attitude on we're in, we're out, we're in, we're out, didn't have a place at the table. While Australia did, what do we have to do to get there? What do we have to tell Canadians about why it's important to get there?
Well, they sort of in or out with pertain to Iraq. But when it comes to Afghanistan, which is a mission that I think most people in Canada would agree is clearly in our security interest, it's in our interest to stabilize a failed state like Afghanistan. We've been there almost from the beginning. We've been there since early 2002. So in effect, we've been in for a long time. It's just maybe not recognized south of the border.
And that lack of recognition is a problem. We've had a member of our board, actually, the institute, who's now Commander Richard Gimlet, Director of Naval Communications, who actually wrote a book called Operation Apollo that defined our role there, which wasn't spoken about. Why don't our political leaders tell Canada about what we do there? We mounted the largest operation since Korea, 16 warships, 4,300 soldiers and seamen. Why weren't we told? What is it about our mindset?
I'm not sure, what the Kretchen, because it was the Kretchen government that didn't want to talk about our role over in the Arabian Sea during...
Nor Martin's in 2004.
Pardon me?
Nor Martin's in 2004.
Well, the mission that Richard Gimlet was talking about was Operation Apollo, which went from 2001 to 2003, and that was our ships over there in some ways part of the war in Iraq, but our government said no, we're not, because we were in the Arabian Sea, not in the Persian Gulf.
It was a cute distinction.
From the Kretchen government's perspective, they did want to make a distinction between sort of the broader role on terror, intercepting ships that may be carrying terrorists or weapons of mass destruction, and ships that were actually in the Persian Gulf contributing to the war in Iraq, which, of course, is in the spring of 2003.
How do we convince Canadians that we need a stronger military presence today? And you talk about that. You talk about, in your papers, the specifics of military might that we need.
What we need to do is, now leaving Iraq aside, what we need to do is tell Canadians how important it is to stabilize failed states like Afghanistan, where I single out Afghanistan because that was a state where Al-Qaeda took refuge, safe haven, and from which the attacks on New York City and the Pentagon were planned. And so a failed state like Afghanistan, it's something that we do need to stabilize. It's in our security interests here in North America. So that's sort of the first part of the message that the Canadian government needs to put out to the Canadian people. And I think that's really what Stephen Harper was getting at when he traveled to Afghanistan and said, hey, we're here for the long term. It's important to rebuild this failed state.
Is part of it a political question? Is part of it a process of educating Canadians of the necessity for this engagement because of what Omar Arjaman has said is the role of the pseudo-religious political parties in undermining any work that's done by anybody over there, any groups over there?
Certainly education is a big, big part of it. And making the case, I don't think we saw the leadership on the part of Kretchen or Martin in terms of making the case for being over there the way Harper has now made the case with his visit last week. That's part of it, but also it's explaining just how different the missions are today as compared to the Cold War peacekeeping, which people are used to, the traditional peacekeeping operations, and those are gone now. We're in a very different security environment, and of course with that brings all sorts of equipment challenges, capability challenges for the Canadian forces.
I want to bring that up with you. I know you've got a tight schedule this afternoon, but we'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about how to mature Canada's role on the world stage. I think the conversation reached that level. We've got Rick McConomy in studio with us, Colonel Peter Reynolds, Special Advisor to the United Nations Advisory Team in Iraq, overseeing the election. Homa Arjamand on the phone from Toronto. We've been talking with Professor Eleanor Sloan. Professor Sloan, you made a very important point right at the end of the last segment. Words matter. How do we talk to Canadians and make them understand that peacekeeping is not a sainted phrase, and it's okay to use your phrase, peace enforcement, or even, as General McKenzie says, they're shooting at us. We've got soldiers. We're there to kill the bad guys. What is wrong with Canadians that they can't accept that?
Well, I think that most Canadians are used to the traditional peacekeeping, the Pearsonian peacekeeping, and it's almost part of the culture, and it's something that even I know my students at the university, they've all heard of our role in peacekeeping during the Cold War, and it's something that doesn't go away very quickly. It's a nice way to think about Canadian capabilities overseas.
But Peter Reynolds, you were there. Rick, our role in the Balkans, we weren't peacekeepers necessarily. We were being shot at, and Canadian soldiers serving with the UN had to shoot back, and they had to shoot back at some very bad people who are, you know, killing people in mass graves.
There are some subtle differences between peacemaking and peacekeeping, and peacemaking includes being shot at to a greater or less extent. I mean, and actually having fire go outwards as well.
I remember visiting the Golan Heights years ago, and, you know, the guys that were there in the light blue hats, you know, we knew that they were peacekeepers and that they were sort of be standing in the middle between the two groups. We never really foresaw that they would be the ones getting shot at and shooting back. I'd like that distinction cleared up for me personally. I thought for a very long period of time that we were in these situations because we were standing between two conflicting parties. In the end, our role has dramatically changed, and I don't think we've delivered that information to the...
And one of the difficulties is having to insert yourself between the two conflicting parties. That's where the real difficulty lies.
Peter, know. Eleanor, we've just been joined by Senator Consiglio Dinino of Toronto. Con Dinino, how are you, Con? Thanks for taking the call.
My pleasure.
We're discussing how to address Canadians. The Prime Minister gave us a challenge for generational transformation. He said, Canada has to be here. We're a nation that has to be at the table. We have to offer up hope. It's the first time in a generation that a Canadian leader is talking about freedom as a central core Canadian value. Now, how do we talk to Canadians? What words do we use to make them understand that this is a good thing?
Well, first, I think we have to come to terms with is the fact that peacekeeping is something of the past. It's gone, at least in the current conflicts. Peacekeeping is no longer what we're doing. We're at war. We're at war with an enemy which is probably one of the ugliest and one of the toughest and one of the most inhumane enemies you'll ever see. In the old days, you had two sides, one with one uniform, one with another. They shot at each other and blah, 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 which was ugly, of course, but still, this is an even uglier because you don't know who your enemy is. So peacekeeping is not something that is part of the, at least in the current conflicts that we're in Afghanistan, obviously, but also for the other countries in Iraq. We're there to defeat an enemy. We're there to defeat an enemy which is not distinguishable like it used to be in the past. So that, I think that's the first message we have to get across to people. And by the way, when I was in Afghanistan last August, the soldiers fully understand that. And there's no question that that they're no longer, you know, under the illusion that this is something standing between two sides and trying to keep them apart. As far as, you know, the other messages are concerned, I think Canada has always been. I mean, it distinguished itself in the Second World War, and since then, it's always been at the forefront of conflicts between people, where our interest, the Canadian interest, which is really world interest, and we're there at stake. And so, I think that this is another message we need to make awfully clear. We can't be sort of the good guys, the Boy Scouts that sit on the side and watch these things happen.
Eleanor Sloan, Senator Dinino just made a very important point, and the numbers are remarkable. In World War II and Korea, Canadians had twice the number of citizens in uniform as the Americans. How do we make Canadians understand the consequence of our participation in the world?
Well, certainly an effort of communication on the part of the government. And one of the things I think in terms of getting the message across that you might want to focus on is the fact that the old peacekeeping, the traditional peacekeeping was between states. And you had blue helmets going on a border between state parties. And those state parties basically controlled their forces, and they agreed to the peacekeeping mission. Now what we have is missions that are within states. Almost all of our missions are within states, perhaps with the exception of our one that's still on the Golan Heights. And so the forces that are there, the warlords, they're not necessarily in control of the people who are carrying out the activities. So it's a much more dangerous environment for our Canadian soldiers.
I know both of your schedules are pressed, but please stay with us for one moment. We'll be back right after this. Montreal, we're back. We've got Senator Con Dinino from Toronto on the line with Professor Eleanor Sloan from Ottawa, Colonel Peter Reynolds and student Rick McConomy. And the question is how to make Canada grow up and assume a leadership role without the nice words. I just took a call off the air and somebody said to me during the conversation, you're like a rebel. Well, obviously I'm not like a rebel, I am a rebel. Senator Danino, do we need to make Canadians rebellious again? Is that the challenge that the Prime Minister has set out to us? And to Professor Sloan, are we too chicken shit to take that challenge? Let's go to Senator Danino first, because I think his schedule is even tighter than yours, Professor.
Well, look, there's a concept that Canada developed called the responsibility to protect.
Correct. This paid for it. International Commission on State Sovereignty.
I think this is a marvelous thing. I personally am in total support of that. If people are being butchered, we got to go in, whether it's a sovereign state or not, we got to go in and try to help our fellow men. We just cannot stand by and watch children and women get raped and as I said, butchered. That's the one thing that I think Canadians have to start understanding, that if we're going to be part of the world, particularly a country like ours, where, you know, our country is made up of practically every nation, every culture, every race and creed in the world. And wherever there are conflicts, we have people here that are neighbors, that are our brother-in-laws and are part of our family. So I think we need to be able to make sure that Canada or the Canadian public understands that we are there to the degree that we can to help protect the innocent from the despots and the nuts that sometimes occupy high positions in countries. I think that's a very important message. And, yeah, I think sometimes we tend to be really the Boy Scouts. And the Boy Scouts also learn that if a bear attacks you, you got to fight back, otherwise it'll eat you up. So let's get a little tougher and let's get a little angry. I think we need to, realize that if we're going to be part of the world, we're going to have to take the good with the bad.
And we got Senator Condonino, thanks very much. I know you're pressed for time. Thanks for coming
that.
On. Professor
thanks,
Sloan, if we don't engage outside our borders, if we maintain this nice, chummy, smug, salon liberal Canadian attitude that social justice stops at our borders, will our failure to engage not eventually corrode whatever just society we're trying to build at home?
Security, it starts at home, but there's a big, big overseas element. You have to stabilize those failed states. It's going to be very difficult, very dangerous. And to get back to your question earlier, I do think that the Canadian public is prepared emotionally to make the transition from the sort of Boy Scout peacekeeping to the new world of war fighting and the difficulties of warfare within states. And what's happened is that the traditional peacekeeping has been perpetuated, I think the whole idea of it, by the Canadian government, by the Chrétien government post-World War, or post-Cold War, and now the Harper government is starting to say, no, hey, this isn't the way things are anymore, and explaining things to the Canadian public.
But, Eleanor, we're also talking about, at the same time, nation building, and we're talking about democracy building and restructure and reconstruction. These are all pieces of that puzzle that are non-military, but they're very, very important, aren't they?
And one of the fundamental things we all have to understand is that the global war on terror is not going to be won on the prairies of Alberta. It's going to be won overseas, initially, and that's where the main effort should be.
In order to keep it out of the prairies of Alberta and the cities of eastern Canada.
Yep.
Professor Eleanor Sloan, we thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We know we're pressed, and we hope to talk with you again soon.
Okay.
Montreal will be right back with you after this. Call us at 790-0006 and tell us, are you tough enough to accept responsibility for relieving suffering around the world? Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in the studio with me. Our special guest, Colonel Peter Reynolds, recently back from Iraq, special advisor to the UN team overseeing the elections. And we're talking about the challenge that was put to us this week by our Prime Minister, and a generational challenge of how to get Canadians involved in the world. And we have Roger on the line from Chateauguay. Member of the forces, Roger? Ex-member?
Ex-member, retired.
Peacekeeping?
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, I think people are overcomplicating things. And the other thing is that the dictators, warlords, and drug cartels in the world have figured this out. To a Canadian soldier that's peacekeeping or peacemaking on the line, the only real difference is that when you're separating two people, or you're there helping the people to bring back the democracy. When you're a peacekeeper and somebody on their side decides to rob their own people and steal all their food, as a peacekeeper, we can't do anything but observe, okay?
Have we bought into the bullshit that the politicians are trying to sell us?
I think things have been really dramatically overcomplicated. And in Yugoslavia, they figured it out. And when we were there peacekeeping, and we told the Croats not to kill the Serbs and the Serbs not to kill the Croats, and if they did, the UN, you know, would arrest the leaders didn't get arrested. So what we had to do is observe and take notes. And the people, the bad people around the world, have figured this out.
What do you think, though, Roger, this does to us as Canadians that we're so scared of recognizing the nobility of service and sacrifice, of soldiering?
Well, the thing is in Canada, for some reason, there's a lot of sensationalism in the newspapers, for one.
Right.
Every member of the forces today and ex-members found that there's a lot of sensationalism. And unless there was sensationalism and something big happened, we didn't hear anything. Like in Cyprus, when the Turks invaded the Greek side of, and they were all Cypriots. It was just their heritage. A lot of Canadians got killed, and there was huge battles by the with the Canadian Airborne Regiment that got disbanded. And I remember coming home, and nobody knew about it. You know, nobody knew that two of our friends got killed. Nobody knew that a guy in my section and one commando of the Canadian Airborne Regiment got one of the highest Canadian courage medals for what he did in Cyprus.
Roger, what? How do you react to the fact that they're starting to cover car accidents and guys that whose car went off the road and they broke their arm?
Well, you see, but they're over there, and the guy that's writing it for the press has to justify his job. So if he's not sending in stories, they're going to send him home.
Right.
You know what I mean? So he's over there, you know, writing on anything. And when they're writing, the first thing you hear is Canadian soldiers got killed, and then you hear they got killed in an accident. Well, what happened with the Canadian soldiers that were in an accident a year ago in Wainwright, when the same vehicle rolled over and somebody got killed? It was on page 25 on the bottom right-hand corner, and, you know, I bet you nobody knows Royal 22nd Regiment soldier's name. His family knows,
yeah,
but nobody else does.
I think the message has to be that we have to start getting people to more understand, even the people that are doing the coverage, have to better understand what the mission is, what we're trying to do, and cover that kind of stuff.
And can I just take you back to something you said at the beginning about fighting and that sort of thing? To some extent, everything that Canadian soldiers, British soldiers, and American soldiers do overseas is actually ruled by the rules of engagement.
Yes,
and who set those rules of
engagement? Nobody follows it. And as a peacekeeper and a peacemaker, nobody follows it. The only difference between the two, as a Canadian soldier, we don't know if we have a blue or green helmet. We get shot at. And if a soldier fights against us, we will fight back. But they won't fight us.
Peter Reynolds, you've been everywhere. Are other nations so scared of the term soldier? And do other nations also cloak what their role is in this word of peacekeeping, or is it singular to Canada, or some kind of stunted mentality?
No, it isn't singular to Canada. In the aftermath of the Cold War, I mean, soldiering became it wasn't flavor of the month. All militaries were downsized, and yours probably more than most other people's.
But I'm old enough, I was in the Cold War, and right. I was stationed in Germany, and I was there with tanks that were twice the age as I was, facing the Soviet Army in West Germany. But let's get back to what peacemaking is, okay?
Roger, can I just interrupt you? We need to go pay some bills. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Stay with us, Roger.
Okay.
Montreal, we're back, and we're talking about Canadian consequence in the world. In studio, Rick McConomy, Colonel Peter Reynolds, and we've got Roger from Shattuck on the line. Roger,
Hi.
Let's continue what we were talking about. What is it going to take for Canadians to realize the important role of soldiering, that it's not a matter of peacekeeping, it's not a matter of a name, it's a matter that we're out there relieving suffering and helping people under oppression?
Well, let me finish what peacemaking is so that we kind of understand the difference. Peacekeeping, we observe, we don't take part in what goes on, okay? We stand in between that the two people, you know, won't attack each other, but we will not prevent them from attacking from within. Peacemaking is we not only observe, but we also tell them that, look, the drugs stop here. The stealing food from the starving people stops here. We're here to make sure that life becomes normal again. We tell the dictators, the rebels, the warlords, the drug cartels that, look, it's over, okay? We've come here as policemen, basically, to bring peace in this area. And if you do anything, we will arrest you, and we will bring you to the, let's say, like in Afghanistan, they'll bring them to the Afghanistan police and have them arrested, okay? Now, if we don't go, who goes? Now, think of southern Afghanistan now. There's towns where the judges have left, the police have left, the lawyers have left, the mayor has left, okay? There's nobody in that town anymore. It's being run by drug cartels and warlords, and they're not always very pleasant with for the people that their own people. Us as Canadian soldiers, we say, you know, this has to stop. You need to bring democracy and normalcy around the world. We there as soldiers go into the town, start to say, like we're here to protect you people so you can have live a normal life. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and drug dealers and warlords leave or hide within the people. And then once we start bringing peace and, you know, we maybe arrest some people, then all of a sudden the police aren't afraid to come anymore. Then all of a sudden the judges aren't afraid to come back. And life starts back. We start helping them to get water and shelter. And, you know, that's what we're doing over there. And that's what people have to understand. And the problem is that there's a lot of people that don't want us to do that. They want to keep things the way they are because they've earned their living doing it, doing what they're doing.
They're benefiting from things falling apart.
Yes, and they're bad people. But, you know, but
and in behind like, all of that,
The CARE and the Red Cross won't even go into that town.
Rick, don't you think that Roger just made the clearest statement? They're bad people.
He made an excellent statement. Roger, this is probably one of the most articulate descriptions of that situation that I've heard in a very long time. Congratulations. I think you're a person who...
And one of the real problems they've got over there is, of course, that if there's no judicial system in place, if there are no police there, what the hell do you do with the guys once you've arrested them? If the prison service doesn't work?
No, we bring them to the next town where there is normalcy. There is normalcy in the north. You know, we do what we can. What would you do? I was a sergeant in the Canadian Airborne Regiment, okay? And put yourself as a peacekeeper in a town. There's bad people stealing food from their own people, okay? Now you arrest them. What should I do with them? What is an intelligent thing for me to do as a Canadian soldier? I bring them to the military police. Our military police, they have police stations, they have prisons. They put them in there. They speak to the local government area. And this isn't just Afghanistan. This is Yugoslavia. This is Zaire. This is everywhere in the world. This is what Canadians have done. This is what we need to be proud of. We have been peacekeepers and peacemakers. The bad guys have figured out that peacekeeping doesn't always work. It still does in certain cases, but sometimes you need to be a peacemaker. You arrest them, and then where there is a larger town where there is normal police, and that's where, and anywhere in the world, that's where you bring them.
So you're fighting lawlessness.
Yes.
To a very large extent, and that's the contribution to the security and the peace of the people that live there.
Yes, and the thing is that the soldiers don't want to fight Canadian soldiers over there. Because they do have armies, they don't want to fight us. Because they know, first off, you know, Canadian soldiers are intelligent. We're volunteers. We're there because I joined the army, okay? And I keep hearing this things about the U.S. Army, Canadian Army. We are not the same. Nowhere near the same mentality, nowhere near the same thought pattern when we go into different countries around the world.
Peter Reynolds uses a phrase that Canada can be the conscience of the coalition.
And we are.
That seems to be what you're talking about.
Yes, and a lot of times, like when I was stationed in Germany, I got paid in German marks. So that I took, you know, the German people looked upon us as, you know, part of them, you know. The Americans lived on their bases. They hardly ever came out except to party. And when they were there, they got paid in U.S. dollars. And they tried to pay in U.S. dollars outside the base. You understand? It's a whole different mentality.
A whole mindset.
Roger, yeah. I want to thank you for the call. You're one of the most intelligent callers we've had. And we hope you call back next week. We've got somebody waiting from Paris, but I want to underline to Montreal what Roger has said. This is something to be proud of. And what we do is something to be proud of. And we can be the conscience of a coalition. And we can be the conscience of even our big brother next door. Roger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
We now go to another type of conflict, the civilian conflict, and we welcome Leonard Deichler, the Institute's associate in Paris. Leonard, how are you? Thanks for being on the line with us today. Thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
We're going to go to another type of civilian conflict that's received a lot of press, in particularly in Quebec, and that's these massive demonstrations we've been seeing and have been on the front page of Le Devoir, of La Presse, of the Gazette, the students protesting this new labor law that would give employers the right to terminate employment of these students, but it was supposedly put in to encourage employment, and the Prime Minister de Villepin of Paris is standing by this, and yet we've got these scenes of outrage throughout France. Could you talk to us a little about what was behind this law and what is the objection to it?
The idea of the law was to give the young a chance to get employment. And while this sounds a little bit crazy, you look at the sound, the sondage, the
polls.
The polls today, 70% of the French public is against the CPE. The standing of Villepin has gone down to negative, something like a 64 or 65.
The CPE, by the way, just for our listeners, CPE in Quebec is daycare. CPE in France is the acronym for the law.
Yeah, contrat première embauche, which is the first employment.
Right, first line employment, yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, I haven't followed the press in Quebec or Montreal or even in Canada. I think people are overlooking something that in the education system in France is totally blocked. The political situation in France is blocked. The decisions were taken from the top downwards. The riots last year in the suburbs were sort of a reflection of what is going on here. People are not integrated into the system. There is education that is completely out of date. And the elites continue just on their way of doing things. They've done it a long time.
Leonard, I want you to address a question right after this break. We're going to go pay some bills. And the question is the opposition to this law the fear that if they can fire the students that are hired for no cause, that will affect other jobs and other union contracts? And we'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, we're back with the Institute's associate in Paris, Leonard Deichler, and we're talking about the riots that have erupted in France over this new law that, on the one hand, seeks to increase youth employment but gives employers the right to terminate that employment at will without cause. Len, in the New York Times yesterday, the report was that the unions particularly and the opponents of this law feel that it will erode employment rights and benefits. Can you speak to that? How would it do that if we're talking about temporary employment?
It will erode rights, and at the same time, what is the question of how do you employ get people to get employed? You have a 50% unemployment in the poor areas of Paris with impoverished youth, which is part of the article, and you have 20 to 25% unemployment with people coming out of university.
And I believe very high unemployment in France generally today, about 15% it hovers, 14%?
I would say it's around between 10 and 12%, but does that include the hidden unemployment and things like that?
So why was this done to begin with?
Well, this law was attempted 10 years ago under Balladur when he was prime minister, and at the same time, again at the time, there were heavy reactions by the youth and the trade unions, and that law was also taken back. It was called the CIP at the time, which I forget exactly what it meant at the time, but the problem in France is the educational system. The problem in France is the fact that the elites, whether it's the left or the right, just decide from the top downwards what they should do, what not to do. And by the fact that there is this heavy reaction, is every couple of years you have this heavy reaction. Every time there's some kind of an attempt to reform the educational system, there's a heavy reaction. There was an interview with Daniel Cohn-Bendit today who said that...
Who led the 68 riot.
Yeah, which is very different, very, very different. At the time, it was a very positive reaction against what they would call a very uptight system or a very, very blocked system. And today, you have a system that is where people are just reacting very negatively with fear.
Yeah, but Leonard, I have young people that I'm connected with and related to in Paris and mm-hmm. across France. Their problem seems to be that they can't get a job that lasts more than 3 months or 6 months. Every job is a temporary.
Right.
They don't have to pay the social benefits. The minute the social benefits come along, you're no longer a busboy or a waiter or a manager. I mean, I know people that have the skills to manage 300 people in a restaurant complex, but they can't get offered employment for more than 6 months because they can't afford to pay the social benefits.
Taxes are very high here, and it's the answers would require much, much more... much, much more concentration between the political leaders and the social leaders, something like that. The society is blocked here. And until this something is unblocked, problems will continue.
So you've still got this concrete ceilings between classes in France?
Yes.
They're not glass, they're concrete.
I mean, you know, unless people are integrated as immigrants, they will react. I mean, the first generation were so happy to have the jobs here. But they never said anything, never any complaints that people came here in the 50s and 60s. But people who were born here, who are, let's say, Turkish or Algerian or Moroccan or other origins, it's very, very difficult either to enter schools or to get jobs.
To break into the schools, to break into the professions.
It's very, very difficult. In Canada, people do not realize how much more open the system is.
Oh, no. We live in a country of upward mobility,
right,
and an ability to move that way. I know I have friends there in the legal system and even the judicial system where they line the judge's date of graduation and the placement in their class.
Right.
And for their entire lifetime, there
right.
is no merit movement. They get to bid exclusively on the fact of they were graduated in this year, 12th in their class.
Right.
They get a national list, and that's how their life is run.
People who have graduated from the École Nationale d'Administration, which is the people like the Villepin, Chirac.
Which I understand they've now taken apart and moved out of Paris to Strasbourg.
Well, the situation is that these people take it for granted that they are meant to lead, they are born to lead, and that things will be like that forever. They cannot imagine, in any way, manner, or form, that they are the ones who are the cause of the problems.
Yeah, exactly, because they're sitting there, and some poor kid says that my folks didn't come here originally, or they didn't get to here or there. The connection system is unbelievable. We know it's a problem in every country in the world, but in France, for some reason...
It seems to be formalized to an extent which is worse than anywhere else.
Very Cartesian, very Cartesian. It's very tightly and tightly gripped.
Len Dykler, thank you for calling.
You're
from
welcome.
Paris. We've run out of time. I want to thank all our guests, Colonel Peter Reynolds, Professor Eleanor Sloan, Senator Conal Danino, Homer Argerman from Toronto, and, of course, as always, Rick McConomy, our technical genius, Larry Martos, our producer, Val Prudnikoff. And I would wish for Canada on this day where Rick McConomy came back after marching with the Fighting 69th Regiment.
The Fighting 69th, down the center
Irish
of the church.
69.
Down the center of the church in St. Patrick's. And I'd like to thank you this week, Beryl, for being such a lovely and wonderful person. And I want to say that it's been a pleasure for you to be here.
In all seriousness, we have to hope that Canada and Canadians get part of that spirit of the Fighting 69th. Montreal, thank you. Our email again is info@iepm.ca. And on this special day where we're all Irish, Erin Gobra. We'll see you next week.